I would reel seven.
I think I'd said that the other submarine successfully torpedoed this U-boat. We didn't sight it. We didn't see any sign of it. The other submarine from its position obviously did, and sank it. And there were a few survivors, two or three survivors from this submarine, which managed to get out of it. When she ended up on the bottom, we were told, some 90 feet down. So that can't have been a very nice experience for the people getting out of it. 90 feet deep water, the effect on your ears, etc. And we didn't see these survivors, but they were brought back to Trincomalee in due course, no doubt thanking their lucky stars to have got out of it. The rest were lost with it. And that's the only thing of moment that happened, except that we were later on told to lie off a certain position further south on the east coast of Sumatra and stand by to pick up any aircraft which headed in our direction, having carried out an attack on I don't know the name of the base, on a base on the west coast of Sumatra, a carrier-borne attack by the Royal Navy. They were going to bomb hell out of this, and it was expected that some of them, unable to get back, would head across the island and head for us. They'd been told that the submarine we were in, would be waiting there. They would ditch in the sea and would be picked up and brought back to safety. And we sat on the surface all day in shallow water there, watched with great interest by local fishermen in their little fishing boats. They were all over the place, in quite shallow water. And ourselves doing a bit of fishing by dropping explosive charges over the side of the submarine and getting some fresh fish to eat, whilst a lookout was kept for any Japanese planes or surface craft that might appear, but only in a rather cursory fashion. I can't remember any feeling of apprehension there. The hot sunshine, only people were allowed on the bridge. Nobody was allowed up on the casing of the submarine, obviously, otherwise it would have been like a pleasure cruise. But doing this bit of fishing, nothing appeared, no plane arrived, nobody to be rescued, and that was the end of that episode. And 4 weeks after we'd set out from Trincomalee, we arrived back in that port at the Adamant, having achieved absolutely nothing again. Very frustrating. And this was, as I said earlier, around about September 44. We carried, after getting back to Trinco, we returned up to Jaffna to our base there, carried on further jungle training, further training on one of the major rivers in Ceylon on a sort of survival exercise, living off the land through the forest, shooting what you could catch, what you could shoot, catching what fish you could, and with very basic rations to fall back on in extremis. And that was very interesting and informative, but it wasn't operations. Towards the end of 44, I was detailed with a sergeant who subsequently became my sort of 2IC with my little subsection of C Group, which consisted in all of about 16 people, as far as I can remember, including four officers, to take a number of foul boats, go to Colombo, report to the RAF there for transport to Calcutta en route for a place called Cox's Bazaar, over on the Bengal coast, near south of Chittagong, I think. I was given the instructions on what to do when we arrived at Cox's Bazaar on a piece of paper, just scribbled like a little torn-off piece of paper. We flew all day up India in a very uncomfortable basic DC-3 aircraft, things that were generally known as Dakotas, with our canoes, arrived in Calcutta, had a transit stop at a hotel in the city, reported next day, flew on to Cox's Bazaar, where we arrived, I suppose, early afternoon, on the beach. The plane landed on the beach, nobody in sight except a few locals, and I felt my pockets, and I'd lost the piece of paper telling me what we had to do when we got to Cox's Bazaar. So that was a great start. There we were, the two of us, with about six canoes, great big bundles, lying on the beach with our own gear. So leaving the sergeant with the gear, I walked across the beach up to the edge of it and could see through the trees, which I couldn't see from the beach. It was a camp, an army camp. And there was quite a big transit camp there, which I suppose was the reason for Cox's Bazaar. So I went to see the camp commandant, explained my predicament. I'd lost the piece of paper of the instructions, which didn't seem to surprise him particularly. Told him I was looking for a group of the SBS. Oh, yes, he said, we're there down at Teknaf. Called in his orderly room sergeant. He said, get through to Teknaf and tell them there are two blokes have arrived here from Ceylon to go there. We went with the sergeant, and he cranked away at a field telephone. And much to my surprise, was answered. My experience of field telephones was they invariably failed. But this answered, and we could hear a voice faintly at the far end, like somebody speaking in a tin can. And yes, Lieutenant Sherwood and Sergeant Penn are here. Oh yes, we're expecting them. We'll send a truck up for them. And I suppose Teknaf maybe lay 50 miles to the south of Cox's Bazaar. And in due course, who should turn up at the truck at the transit camp but my old friend George Barnes, with whom I'd served in the Middle East. We'd been together the whole time. He went in a different group, A group, who'd gone out to Ceylon before we did. But there he was, and he brought the truck up. We were home dry again. Canoes were picked up. We were whisked down to Teknaf. And within a day or two of going there, one of the officers of A group, who was due to go on an operation, a recce down the coast, went sick. So they said, what about it? Would you like to go experience and so on? The rest of C group was to come to follow up later. They were still in the Ceylon. So I said yes, and when the time came, we pushed off late in the afternoon in a motor gunboat. I think it was the Royal Indian Navy. A tremendous bunch of blokes running those things, too. They were white officered, white commanding officers, and Indian junior officers, and ratings. And we motored down gently down the Naff River into the Bay of Bengal, and by nightfall were some miles to the north of where we were supposed to land, so we were able to approach unseen. Obviously, we needed to. In due course, the engine stopped. They dropped the anchor. There was only a slight swell, which we discovered later for the Bay of Bengal can be a very different thing when it actually reaches the beach, but still. We got our canoes over the side, ready to go ashore. And at that moment, one of the blokes, there was no moon again, it was a starry night, so quite clear, but he leaned against a point in the railings where there wasn't any railing and promptly fell overboard and was hauled back on the board, dripping wet, greeted with rather rude comments in an undertone. No loud voices, obviously, because we weren't that far off the beach. And we could see fires burning at different points in the trees that fringe the beach. So he was dried down and squeezed out, got into his canoe, still wet, obviously, but then what did it matter in tropical climate? And we set off to the beach. And by this time, we'd developed a technique which had never, for some reason, occurred to anybody before, of getting through surf. And that was not to run in and try and plane into the beach in the canoe, but turn her head round, because she was facing out to sea. Watch for the moment at which the horizon went black, which it did when a wave started to build up ahead of you, and paddle like hell into it, and bash through it before it actually broke, or whilst it was breaking. And you had enough speed on to go straight through it, ship the minimum amount of water, and remain upright. Once that had passed, you paddled astern as fast as you could go and waited till the same thing happened. Another darkening of the horizon, another paddle forward and a break through the wave. And with successive waves, eventually got into the beach, reasonably dry shod, and upright, which was the main thing, and with all your gear with you. And this we did on this occasion. A group had already discovered how to do this. It was new to me. And I thought, why had anybody never thought of this before? In the earlier days of training, nobody had ever occurred to anybody, nobody at all. So we were on the beach, home and dry. We pulled the canoes up just above the waterline. A bloke was detailed to stay with the canoes. It was very quiet, and we could hear some drums thumping away in the trees ahead of us across a very, very wide, white sandy beach. And we kept crouched down, for obvious reasons. And whilst we were edging our way cautiously across the beach, since the object was to glean information, not stir up a hornet's nest, we heard somebody whistling. Looking up to our left, saw a figure ambling along the beach, whistling to himself. We didn't know who he was, whether it was a Jap or who. So we lay down in the sand, and I remember I had alongside me a great big hulking bloke who'd been a member of the Manchester City Police Force before the war and volunteered for and got into the army and eventually the commandos. And I said to him, "You grab him." Great bloke like this. We all lay in the sand. The bloke came nearer and nearer, totally unsuspecting, whistling happily to himself. And the next minute, a huge figure loomed up in front of him, grabbed him, put his hand over his mouth, dragged him down onto the sand. It was really quite amusing. He was no Jap. He was only a young local, a Burmese. But he was a coast watcher appointed by the Japs to look out for people like us trying to land. So he was terrified out of his wits. He thought he'd be killed there, here and then. He spoke English. A little. Enough. We reassured him there was no intention of killing him. But we wanted him to lead us to the nearest village, which we knew was in that vicinity. He agreed to do so and said there was a Japanese sergeant living in a basha being a locally made hut from bamboo and this sort of thing, and he would take us so that we could get this Jap as well, if not get him alive, kill him anyway. If we got him alive, bring him back with information, intelligence and so forth for the army proper. But only if we take him back with us, because if we left him, obviously his fate was sealed. So we agreed to do that as well. Because you could always stuff somebody else under the long canopy in the bow of the canoe, very uncomfortably, but you could fit three in it at a pinch, which meant that the chap paddling at the front had the passenger's head in his lap. The passenger was just sort of in a coffin or a canvas coffin, unable to move. And if the canoe capsized, it would be a hell of a job to get out. But that didn't arise. He led us up further up the beach onto a track through some bushes, and we could hear this drumming noise getting louder, and then we could see flames from a fire. The officer in charge of this operation, a chap by the name of Holden White, gave us our respective roles. You know, you stay and cover that track, shoot anything that appears on it, etc. He set up his party to be led to the basha where the Jap was. And as we got close to that, we could see light shining through the split bamboo of the walls and hear voices. The plan evolved was that this local would go to the door, tap on it, and get the Jap to come to the door outside on some pretext or other, and whereupon he'd be grabbed or shot, whichever seemed to be necessary. And you wouldn't believe this, would you? There must have been about probably eight of us in this operation, all well-armed, with pistols and Tommy guns. The chap went to the door. We heard voices. They stopped for a moment. The door opened. A figure appeared in the light from a hurricane lamp or something similar and came outside. And they must have realized something wasn't quite right. Perhaps he spotted one of us or something. Next thing, he took to his heels, pursued by a sort of fusillade of shots, none of which got him. It just shows you, know, when somebody firing and all, a bloke still gets away with it. And this sort of thing obviously happened time and again throughout the war. And he escaped. A search was made of the hut, and all sorts of valuable information, intelligence information was found there, all kinds of instructions in Japanese and all sorts of stuff like that. So Holden White was well satisfied with that. We were very disappointed the Jap had got away. We were more disappointed because the Coast Watcher chap had told us it was a Japanese platoon about half a mile down the road. And they would have heard all these shots. So we thought, here's where we essentially slide out into oblivion and get back to the canoes if we can. So, which we did. The Japs didn't catch up with us. We got our canoes into the water with the coast watcher tucked into the bow of one of them. Unfortunately, no Jap to be accompany him. And got back to the motor gunboat without any further problem. And that was the end of that operation. And we subsequently heard that the intelligence information brought back had proved extremely useful to the Corps commander in that area. So it wasn't entirely wasted. But it was typical of, to me, typical of so many SBS-kind operations, which somehow went off half-cocked very often. What it was due to, don't think I'm sure, really. Perhaps not being adequately prepared for contingencies that might arise. I must say, looking back now, as you get older and you get more and more experience, I'm sure you've found this too, you are more aware of all the things that can happen consequent upon that happening now. You think ahead much more. I can only believe that we didn't think ahead far enough in those times and went in on the basis of you deal with the situation having had a broad plan as it arises, and perhaps under those circumstances that is about the only thing you can do. But it can lead you into rather disappointing disappointing outcome, like when this ruddy Jap got away, pursued by all the bullets in creation, including Tommy gun, which are fairly heavy caliber stuff. We returned to Teknaf, got back, no bother.
What was the date of the operation?
This must have been around either late November, early December, 44. Because soon after we got back from this, A group got their instructions to return to Ceylon. They'd been up there for their tour of duty. And the rest of C group, my group, was coming up to take over. So before Christmas of 1944, A group had been withdrawn and the C group under Livingston had arrived.
Did you go on any more of these Arakan operations?
Yes, I did, as part of C group. That one with A group was just a chance one because I happened to be there and they said, well, it's a good experience sort of thing. And I was keen to go. Once C group was properly set up there, the commando brigade to which we were attached, and I can't remember the number of it, it was commanded by Brigadier Peter Young, who's now a well-known historian, you may have come across him, an enthusiast for resetting ancient battles, you know, like cavalier roundhead battles, restaging that kind of thing. He's getting on in years now. He was the brigadier in charge of that commando brigade, and I can't remember which it was, what it was called, or even which commandos were part of it. But we were attached to that. And shortly after Christmas of 44, which we celebrated in right royal fashion, with a visit by Laycock, who by then was he Combined Operations Chief, I think, back in London, with the Japs across the Naff River, wondering what on earth was going on, no doubt. The commando brigade was ordered to attack and take Akiab, an island further south down the coast, on the Burma coast. That was a completely bloodless invasion, and it was carried out as an invasion with landing craft in proper fashion. We took no part in that. The Japs had gone. There was nobody there except the Burmese. So the brigade, I think there were a few snipers around, but I mean the main force had gone, withdrawn. And they just walked in and took it over. And then later on again, where were we talking of now? January 1945, the operation to capture Ramree Island, further south again, island hopping, so to speak, getting nearer to Rangoon and occupying places like Akiab and Ramree Island for their air base value, attacking eastwards into Burma across the mountains of the Arakan Yoma in support of the 14th Army driving south down the Irrawaddy. We then got our first opportunity to carry out reconnaissances before the landing on Ramri Island, and we had one particularly successful one where we were embarked at Teknaf again, motor gunboat. I think the whole group was involved this time, which was something like eight fall boats. Sailed quietly down the coast, no great hurry, waiting for dusk and ultimately darkness to fall before being dropped over the side, not far from Ramri Island itself. At the edge of what is marked on the charts as Chugpu Harbour, Chugpu being spelled K-Y-A-U-K-K-Y-U, I think. No, P-Y-U, Chugpu, Chalkpu, Chugpu. And with the little town of Chugpu on the northern end of Ramri Island, occupied the whole island by the Japs. We were dropped at the entrance to Chugpu Harbour, which in fact is a huge bay. There's no harbour as such, but dotted with islands all over the place, tree-clad islands. Beautiful-looking landscape for anybody could appreciate that sort of thing. I must say I certainly did. And we paddled to our selected rendezvous on one of these islands, the intention being to establish a small base there from which we would carry out reconnaissances of the surrounding area and of Chugpu town, Ramri Island generally. It was dark when we landed on a rather rocky beach there. No problem, we got ashore, established our little base, waited for daylight to come. And no sooner had it come than figures were seen walking along the beach. So we concealed ourselves until they got near enough for them to be grabbed. And these were Burmese, a Burmese family living on the island, this little island, a kind of refugees from the Japs, across on Ramri Island, which I suppose lay maybe a mile away. They were wholly cooperative. There was a man and his wife and children and a couple of younger men. And they were delighted to see the British coming back again. There was no doubt about this. It was very, very heartening and encouraging. So we would have their cooperation. Livingstone decided that as CO he would have first crack at going across to Chalkpu. And one of the locals volunteered to go with him. He went across with a small party, bumped the Japs, a Japanese patrol, on the road running southwards out of the town along the coast there, without himself being spotted, managed to withdraw and return to the island without having discovered anything in particular, except the Japs weren't asleep. They were patrolling and on the move. And the next night, a bigger force of us, including myself, went back with the same local who knew the area well, who said he would guide us to a village about a mile inland, which sounded to all of us a little bit hairy, a kind of a, not a trap on his part, but a mile inland is quite a long way with the Japs sort of up there. Anyhow, that's what we were there for. So we set off, we landed, this chap led us along dried out paddy fields with their embankments of dried mud separating them. And the walk seemed to go on forever. It was only a mile, in fact. And we thought there were Japs hiding behind every ruddy bush. And our chief fear was being caught by the Japs, obviously, because they weren't very nice with prisoners, as everybody knows now. Treacherous, rightly described as treacherous, cruel people, as indeed, as far as I'm concerned, they still are. I'm not carrying the prejudices of that period, because they didn't do anything nasty to me. But they did lots of nasty things to other British, as everybody knows. I think they're dreadful people. That's an aside. We arrived in this village and were conducted to the basha in which lived the head man of the village. The chap who took us in approached this chap. We were told to stay in the background, at the edge of the village in the paddy fields and the bushes, till he went and did his way forward. He did so, he came back, he said, "It's all right." He said, "There are no Japs around, you can come in." We went into this basha. leaving some of our number outside, armed, guarding it, and had a lot of talk with him. He spoke English, quite an educated man. By this time, the whole village was awake, and they were excited. They showed their excitement of the fact that the British were back in no uncertain manner. You felt it was worthwhile being there. They were glad they were coming back. They had a very rough time under the Japs, and they certainly didn't like them, as applied to any other countries they occupied, too. We got all the information we wanted, including exactly where the Japs were located and how far away. The village knew, the headman knew, it was his business to. Since the Japs were using the locals as forced labor and being very rough with them if they refused. So the headman was only too glad to divulge anything he knew. He got one of his chaps, a young man, to go back with us to the island. And the object there was to take this chap back up to divisional headquarters at Chittagong so he could be questioned there firsthand on what he knew, as well as the information that we could provide from conversation with the headman. We got back to our island. Livingston was staying on for another day or two, and he said, "You and two or three canoes, you take this bloke back, rendezvous with the motor gunboat," and once again we got a time, an alternative time, if the first rendezvous failed, which was lying off one of the islands in a position which we knew already. And the motor gunboat was there. We got back without mishap. Hell of a long paddle of about 6 miles to get to this rummy thing. And I had this chap in the bow, with his head in my lap. And the effect of that was to keep the bow of the canoe slightly down in the water. And paddling was absolutely, although we were used to paddling, it was really hard work, and we were jolly glad, relieved, to get back to the motor gunboat, which immediately got us on board, set off, got to Teknef by daybreak the next morning, and there was a message there. They wirelessed on ahead that we were on our way up. There was a message waiting for me to take myself and the Burmese up to Chittagong as soon as possible, and go and see the general and let him question and ask what it's all about and so forth. Which we did, and we were driven once more back up the coast road to Teknef, to Cox's Bazaar, then on to Chittagong. We had a very interesting session with the general, who was, his name was Lomax. It was the 26th Indian Division, I can well remember. He was very pleased with the information he got from us and from this local chap, whom they were able to question at great length, and who we didn't take back with us, but who was eventually taken back to his island home, along with the invasion fleet, which eventually took Aramri Island a few days later. So he had all the excitement of seeing a bombardment. I think it was one of the battleships involved in this. They shelled Aramri as hard as they could go, the 15-inch shells battleships carry. So this local, who probably never been out of Aramri area in his life, saw all this happening before his eyes, was been thrilled to bits. Indeed he was, because we met him later in the same village which we used to visit after we took on up our own base at Chalkpew on Aramri Island, when we ourselves landed there. And then from that little base at Chalkpew, we continued to do a fairly continuous number of recce expeditions, further inland again, and further south again. The Japanese had been driven by the main body of the army, British and Indian, the 26th Indian Division.